the person who chose San Francisco was Stettinius. He decided that it was one of America's most beautiful cities. The climate would be good at that season of the year. And the trip across the continent, whether by plane or by train, would impress all the foreign delegates with the immensity of the United States. And Roosevelt readily agreed when Stettinius at Yalta said that he proposed San Francisco, and the agreement had already been.
And you were appointed to be Secretary General of this conference, which meant running all the details.
I had responsibility for recruiting the entire staff, and it was a huge staff to run such a big conference. I was responsible for seeing that we got hotel space, automobile transportation, details of the mechanics of running an organization, and actually aiding the presiding officers. The presiding officers, since four nations were the inviting nations, because China was included, the presiding officers were T.V. Sun of China, Molotov of the Soviet Union, Anthony Eden of Great Britain, and Stettinius as our representative. And they alternated in presiding at the plenary sessions.
How many?
And Stettinius as our representative. And they alternated in presiding at the plenary sessions.
How many nations took part in the conference?
A total of 50.
Which was all but one of the original members of the United Nations, yes? Wasn't, I think, Poland?
No, listen, I'm including Poland.
Well, can you give us some of... This was a two-month event. Can you give us some of the highlights?
The main contentions were between the smaller powers and the great powers. The unity which had been preserved of the great powers at Yalta still prevailed on issues where the great powers' interests seemed different from the smaller powers. The champion of the smaller powers was Herbert Evatt of Australia, who was, I think, then their foreign minister, who later became prime minister. What resolved the disputes, naturally the smaller powers wanted greater say than had apparently been given in the drafts agreed to by the great powers. What really met the needs of the smaller powers was the insistence on equal voting power of all members in the assembly. And were this to be changed, as some people in the current U.S. administration want, it would wreck the whole purpose of the U.N. There's been talk of weighted voting, so that the larger countries would have greater voting power in the assembly. This having been the chief benefit the smaller powers found in the United Nations, it would completely change the understanding on which the whole organization is based. That was one difficulty that persisted throughout, but which was happily resolved. The most interesting aspect of the drafting was that the two primary drafters were a white Russian American, Leo Pasvolsky, who had been the leader of the whole study group throughout the preparation period before I became deputy director of special political affairs. He was a master of negotiation, knew the history of the League, knew the history of the work on the UN, and his opposite number in drafting was a member of the Russian delegation named Arkady Sobolev. So it is an irony that two Russians, one white and one red, a little spoken about event, were the chief drafters, and they dealt well together. They were able to work either in Russian or in English, and they took into account the interests of others. There was never any objection that I heard as Secretary General to the formulae that those two agreed among themselves would represent the final decisions of the conference.
Was Andrei Gromyko on the scene?
Gromyko was there, as he had been in Yalta and as he had been at Dumbarton Oaks.
Do you have any reflections on his what seems to be extraordinary ability to last out all the twists and turns and changes in leadership, both at home and abroad, that have kept him in the positions he's been in for over 40 years now?
Well, I'm not an expert on Soviet affairs, so I don't know how he managed that. But certainly he was an impressive negotiator. He was rather dour, not noted for jokes or for any kind of ease of manner, but he was a serious negotiator and could be relied upon to stick by what he said, so that I had a chance to see him in operation at Dumbarton Oaks, at Yalta, and of course at San Francisco.
Would you describe the course of events at San Francisco as generally proceeding smoothly, or were there an awful lot of problems that you had to iron out?
There was at least one occasion when there was a major rift. Argentina, which had aided the Axis powers under Perón during the war, was not invited, and it had been agreed at Yalta that Argentina would not be invited. At one of the plenary sessions, a motion was made by a South American country that Argentina be admitted as a founding member. Someone seconded it. A vote had to be taken, and there was a majority in favor. Molotov was furious. We were caught by surprise, the American delegation. It had come about through, certainly with the knowledge and maybe the connivance of Nelson Rockefeller, but Stettinius, the head of the delegation, didn't know him. And the Russians found it difficult to believe, particularly since Molotov was a very suspicious person anyway, found it difficult to believe that this hadn't been an American trick. So that you can imagine that this caused a serious rift. It in turn led to Molotov taking an unjustified position about the extent of the veto. At Yalta, it had been agreed that the veto would not apply to mere discussions of issues before the Security Council, including cases in which one of the permanent members was involved. Molotov said that the veto should apply even to discussion if a major power was involved. this necessitated sending Harry Hopkins, who was not well at all, to Moscow to speak to Stalin. And it's the one instance where, for a moment, there was disagreement about what had been in the words agreed to at Yalta. In this case, the disagreement was very brief. Stalin immediately agreed with our position, with what Hopkins was saying, and instructions were sent to Molotov to change his position. This, I would say, was the most dramatic rift that I can recall, and obviously it didn't result in elimination, in breakdown of the conference. As far as the daily work was concerned, the conference worked in different committees dealing with different parts of the charter, and drafting was done with amendments and regular parliamentary procedure, and then what had been worked out in the committees went to Sobolev and Pasvalsky for final drafting.
Looking back, are there certain aspects of this conference that strike you as, and that struck you at the time as having been extraordinary successes?
Well, I think the great success of the conference, of course, was that while the war was still going on, while there were strains and differences of policy, 50 nations could agree on such a forward-looking document, an idealistic document like the United Nations Charter. So the success, the great success, was in the final agreement.
Did you, from your first-hand participation with them in Dumbarton Oaks and Yalta and San Francisco, get a sense that there was a willingness to be conciliatory, to be accommodating on the part of Soviet leadership that may have been somewhat thwarted or alienated as a result of the more belligerent approach that Truman was to take, as a result of the hardline Cold War speech that Churchill was to make in Missouri in 1946. Did we miss an opportunity with the Russians at that point that might have been otherwise grasped and resulted in a somewhat less antagonistic post-war period?
I like the way in which you have phrased the question. I think things could have been better. I recognize, and I think we must all recognize, that the two superpowers, the United States and Russia, were bound to have conflicts of policy. The war ended with a series of vacua, of power holes where there had been power in the Far East, where Japan had had its empire, in Eastern Europe, where there had been a whole series of dictatorships in Romania, Hungary, Poland. Naturally, the Russians, having defeated the German armies and taken control, remained there. But there were vacua in Africa. The Italian Empire in Africa disappeared. The natural tendency of great powers is to be drawn to fill a vacuum of power. So we were bound to have issues and conflicts. but I think they could have been resolved without the degree of confrontation and hostility that has come about had Roosevelt lived, had Harry Hopkins lived as Roosevelt's chief lieutenant. Hopkins was an amazingly adroit, thoughtful negotiator, and part of the smoothness of the Yalta negotiations and conference was due to Harry Hopkins' advice, which Roosevelt took quite readily.
Looking back, were you surprised, given the cessation of traditional hostility in this country towards the Soviet Union, brought about by the need to cooperate on similar war aims for the 4 years or so, were you surprised at the quickness with which that hostility sprang to the fore again, almost immediately upon the end of the war?
Well, I was sufficiently surprised so that I did not want to remain on in government service. This is why I chose to leave at that time, because I could see the Cold War was going to be the dominant relationship, and that the UN was not going to be utilized in ways that I had hoped. We are a volatile people. Look at the change in attitude we have toward Japan today compared to the period of the war, and the same in regard to Germany. And we can change again. The reason for the change of attitude toward the Soviet Union were manifold domestic interests that were served by the Cold War. The military were glad to have reasons for remaining enormous in size. They wished to keep troops overseas, whereas the demand of the public when the war was once over was bring the boys home. The development of Cold War tensions gave every reason for the military to achieve bases overseas and keep forces overseas. The manufacturers of military supplies obviously do better when there's a period of Cold War. Think what our economic situation might be today if we had not had the continuing armament build-up that we've had, the armament expenditures, with the war in Korea, the war in Vietnam, and the heavy rearmament under Reagan's administration. So there are many, many people who were served. The Republicans had been out of power for 16 years. So that when Truman ran and they brought up the Cold War and hostility to Russia, and allegation, the Democrats being soft on communism, as a domestic means of local politics. So there were many causes for it, as McCarthy proved by the successes he had in taking that kind of issue and playing it to the hill, exploiting it as he did.
So one result of this, of course, is that in between the signing of the UN Charter in June of 45 and its ratification several months later, already by this time the atmosphere was becoming poisoned enough so that the original hopes for what the UN might accomplish had to be scaled down.
I'm not sure the public was aware of it. I was. And when the first organizational meeting took place in London in January of 46, certainly the tensions had increased.
Had you...
But the manifestation of what I'm speaking of in a public sense didn't come until the speech in Fulton, Missouri, which was not until April of 46.
From Stettin, in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
But you already by this time sensed it in
yes.
the air, and had you already begun to want to get out of the State Department even before January 46?
I had told Mr. Stettinius at the end of the San Francisco conference that I was in touch with my former law firm and thought of going back promptly. He asked me to stay on at least until the UN was firmly established, because he became a representative on the preparatory committee in London getting ready for the first session. And he asked me to stay on for a full year. So I agreed. I stayed until January 47.
January 47?
Right. I stayed for a full year after the first order. I helped see that it was set up in this country. I participated in the debates over the site where the UN should be established, whether in New York or in San Francisco or in Greenwich, Connecticut, Philadelphia, various other places.
When did those debates begin to occur?
Oh, those debates began immediately after the ratification.
And had there ever been talk at that point about locating the UN anywhere outside of the United States?
Yes. Of course, there was some argument for Geneva, where the League had been. That was decided against because it would seem a bad omen, to put it as gently as possible, when the League had failed. Roosevelt had at one time suggested Hawaii. Churchill had at one time suggested Marrakesh. Stettinius, very properly, and the State Department as a whole, opposed such proposals, which would make the UN so remote from events that its influence would be minimal. The ravages of the war in Europe made it really impractical to have the UN set up in France or in England or anywhere in Europe. Stettinius also felt quite strongly that American isolationist sentiment would be neutralized by having it in this country. And the rest of the membership was quite sympathetic with having it here.
There was no strong opposition.
There was no opposition.
You feel that this was, in a way, recognition of the role the United States
yes,
has played in
so.
Being the
but also it was
prime
the
mover?
But also it was the practical fact that Europe was in opposition to set up the UN. We alone, at the end of the war, undamaged as we were, could do that.
Quite a turnabout from the history of the League of Nations to have the country that wouldn't join become the prime, not only the prime mover of the UN, but the host almost without opposition.
That's,
I guess a triumph, definitely a triumph for Roosevelt's foresight and planning.
I think so.
Well,
now the debate as to where to have it in this country, therefore, became a domestic issue.
I see.
And
Was it settled on New York by the time... No, it wasn't settled on New York by the time of that January 46 conference.
Oh, no. No, definitely not.
It wasn't until almost a year later that, as I understand it, the deal was put together where John D. Rockefeller II offered the money to buy the site where the UN is now. Until that time, it was still being debated as to what city to locate it in.
That's true.
Anything you want to say about that January 46 conference? That was your last major UN conference.
UN conference. But I was very active right straight through, including meetings in the assembly in this country at Lake Success and elsewhere. See, I remained at the State Department throughout 46.
But it was...
In charge of UN policies.
But it was a very different State Department, was it not? Were you all the while looking to get out because of the change in atmosphere?
I had already agreed to join the Carnegie Endowment, where I could work on United Nations policy efforts. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Which you would join in 1947?
Which I joined in January 47.
As a director.
But I still had the same staff. I guess the way I would put it was that while I thought the UN was not going to be given the support and opportunities it should have, it was much that I wished to see finished in the technical sense before I left.
And after that meeting in January of 46 in London, it began to meet first in Hunter College in the Bronx, if I'm not
mistaken. The first meetings were in Hunter College.
Now Herbert Lehman College. I was a student at Hunter College in the Bronx, and they used to take us through the gymnasium and point out that that's where the UN began having its meetings. It was a heady experience to know that we were walking on that site.
And then they moved to Lake Success.
And did it stay at Lake Success until the present site was finished?
Yes.
So that was something like 4 years, perhaps?
Right. Well, I think it stayed at Lake Success right until then. I'm not sure of that.
Well, I'd like to ask you to go back in your mind 40 years, and of course nobody could have predicted at that point exactly what world conflicts would erupt in the intervening time, what shifts of power and alignments might take place, but thinking back to your conception at that time of what the UN might accomplish and how the UN might succeed, to what degree would you say that it has, in this period, lived up to your expectations, and in what areas principally has it failed to?
Well, I had naturally hoped that cooperation would continue among the great powers at the time the UN was first being formulated. That was clearly out of the question by the time I left. So I was able to view the UN then as facing strains, and my judgment is that the way it was constructed, it remains available for the great powers to use if they can achieve any kind of cooperation and unity. Without that, it still has been a valuable formulation for three reasons. First, it remains an area where they can confer quietly if necessary. The Berlin airlift was actually settled in the corridors of the UN without anyone noticing dignitaries going back and forth between foreign offices. Secondly, the nations of the world have a place to express their views, which is essential. It's what Senator Vandenberg called a town meeting of the air. The resolutions of the assembly are not formally binding, but they're gradually building up an international law by custom. And it does give the smaller nations a chance to be heard. Third, the subsidiary organs of the UN, which we've referred to only briefly before, in the technical areas, permit the nations of the world in this increasingly interdependent globe to carry out their technical interrelationship in a very effective, practical way, which would be impossible without them. And I refer to things like the telecommunications relationships, agricultural agreements and patterns under the FAO, the organization, farm organization, the postal, aviation, one area after another is taken care of by the specialized agencies. And they are an extremely important integrative factor in the world of today. So in those three aspects, I don't think we could get along without the United Nations. Were the United States, as some people propose, to think of pulling out of the UN, not only would it be a sad commentary on what we had ourselves so largely created, but it would mean turning our back on the world. And as long, to use the phrase of the Declaration of Independence, as long as we have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, the opinions of the rest of the world, we certainly should not dream of doing that. We should remain in the UN and work within it as effectively as possible.
Well, I reiterate what I said at the beginning, that at this point of observances all over of this 40-year history, it's been a great privilege to be able to discuss the beginnings of this organization with you, Mr. Alger Hiss, for your role, very key role in its beginnings, and your firsthand observations of all the great events that led to the launching of the UN. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bond.
Last night I had the strangest dream I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room. The room was full of men, and the paper they were signing said they'd never fight again. And when
you've just been listening to a conversation between Alger Hiss, Secretary General at the Founding Conference for the United Nations, and myself, Richard Barr. It was recorded at Mr. Hiss's home several weeks ago.
And bowed their heads, and grateful prayers were prayed. And the people in the streets below were dancing round and round. And swords and guns and uniforms were scattered on the ground. Last night I had the strangest dream.